From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the first Bletchley Park podcast of 2016. It happened here. This year, we'll bring you stories of the Codebreakers' successes and agonies, all of which they kept completely secret. The first of these stories shows just how important Italian codes were, even before the war, and how much of an impact they had on the fighting in North Africa. Meanwhile, the incredible story of Sacrifice at Sea, which created a turning point in the Battle of the Atlantic, is now beautifully told in Naval Codebreaking Hut 8. We'll hear from those who've told that story and find out how it felt for the nephew of one of the men who died to see it. Also coming up this month, we drop in on the 1940s boutique, which is coming back for more this year to steep us all in a bit of vintage glamour. And we hear from veteran Betty Webb about what it was like to receive her MBE at Buckingham Palace, more than just a brush with royalty, and well deserved. This month's It Happened Here story is not German and it's not Enigma, so you'd be forgiven for not having heard of it. But Bletchley Park was breaking into Italian ciphers as well, which had a significant impact on the war in North Africa. Even before the war began, the government code and cipher school had all but completely mastered Italian ciphers. Unfortunately for GCNCS, though, the Italian armed services changed all their codebooks at the outbreak of hostilities in June 1940. I spoke to Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to delve into this little-known story.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, first of all, tell me about Operation Compass.
Well, Operation Compass is the first attack launched by the British Army in North Africa under General Wavell, who's Commander Middle East at the time. The Italians have invaded Egypt from Libya in September 1940, and they crossed the border and made it about 50 miles into Egypt, and then they basically stopped and built a large defensive camp while they tried to figure out what they were going to do next. And Operation Compass is a plan to attack that camp and basically kick them back out of Egypt.
And this goes back further than 1940, doesn't it? There was concern about Italy before the war.
Very much so. I mean, people think about the Second World War as brought about from a British point of view by the invasion of Poland. And of course, that was the immediate casus belli, if you like. But from a strategic point of view in the 1930s, the big threat to the British Empire isn't so much Germany. It's Italy, because Hitler's ambitions are in, as we know, Poland, Ukraine, Czechoslovakia. These are not countries that are vital to the security of the British Empire. On the other hand, Mussolini wants to expand throughout the Mediterranean, and our possessions in the Middle East, the link to India through the Suez Canal, our oil supplies from Iraq, all of that is absolutely vital to our national safety. As a consequence of that, the British government and the Royal Navy in particular have been very concerned about what the Italians might be up to right through the 1930s, and we followed the build-up of their navy, and they are the biggest strategic threat to the empire, if you like, at that period.
So you can see how North Africa, strategically, in what was clearly becoming a real world war worry, was really important.
Oh, vitally so, yes. And GCNCS, Bletchley Park, of course, is involved in that. Well, they're not at Bletchley Park at that point. GCNCS is still in London, but they're heavily involved in listening to what the Italians are up to and breaking all their various codes and ciphers. In some cases with the Italians, you don't even have to break codes because the Italian Navy transmitted a lot of radio messages in what we call plain language. They weren't encoded at all. You just needed to be able to speak Italian and you could listen to what they were saying. So the consequence of that was by 1938, 1939, the Admiralty and the War Office have a very good idea of how the Italian military forces are constructed, what they're doing, any pre-war exercises they've been doing. So they have a really good grasp of the Italian military situation.
And so what kind of operation was set up in Cairo? How that worked with Bletchley Park, or if it didn't perhaps work so well with Bletchley Park? I know the things at arm's length can be difficult, can't they?
Well, the difficulty was inevitably that GCNCS was a combined services operation that was essentially run by the Foreign Office and by SIS. whereas the Army and Navy and the Air Force all had their own intelligence operations. And particularly overseas, the services tended to do their own thing. And so there are code breaking and wireless intercept operations in the Mediterranean and in the Middle East, but they tend to be individual service operations run by the Army or by the Air Force or by the Navy. And at the same time, you have GC and CS saying, well, we are in charge of code breaking. This should be our responsibility and we should be doing it. Hugh Sinclair, who famously is the director of SIS and thus the controller of GC and CS, as early as 1938, he's saying there should be a branch of GC and CS, a branch of what becomes Bletchley Park in Cairo to do the work locally. But the various armed services take the view that they're happy with what's going on themselves and they can master it all there themselves.
It just shows you that there's no such thing as a new idea, because that, that kind of, nope, my department knows perfectly well what it's doing and we can carry on without cooperating with others, is just perpetuated throughout, well, civil service, I would think, at the very least, but probably big business as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the issues we have with the history here at Bletchley is it's portrayed as this seamless cooperative venture that everybody got on all the time and it was agreed and the best thing was always done. Actually, real life isn't like that, and there was a lot more argument and to and fro about everything, even in the middle of a war. And that's certainly the case with Cairo.
If anything, the urgency and operational need that came with war may have made people dig their heels in even more sometimes. Still got human attributes to deal with, haven't you?
Exactly. And if you think you're right, but you also think it's vitally important, then you're going to think you're righter in a way.
Doubles your determination
to get your point across.
To have your way, yeah.
And the other problem they have is there is a view at GC and CS that they have few enough resources as it is. They have a very small number of code breakers. In September 1939, there's only 180 people come to Bletchley Park, so it's a very small operation at that period. And the idea that these people should start getting shipped off around the world to do code breaking elsewhere isn't a popular idea. And you can quite see how if you're working on something and you think, oh, I need to go and ask so and so else what they think, and they're 5,000 miles away, it's not as easy to do, you know.
There's a delay.
So there's a delay.
Yeah.
La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori di Gran Bretagna e di Francia.
But what happens is in July 1940, once the Italians have declared war, it becomes obvious that some Bletchley Park expertise is required in Cairo. So people are sent out, a small team is sent out then. They then encounter the problem that they're intercepting so much traffic that capturing the messages and then sending them back to London and to Bletchley to be looked at and then getting them back again overwhelms the communication systems they have available. So their point is proven in a way, in that trying to work cooperatively becomes very, very difficult. But they push on with the idea, and in November the whole thing gets put on a formal footing with the establishment of the Combined Bureau Middle East, as it's called, which is another of these wonderful meaningless cover names that describes Bletchley Park activity. And a officer called Freddie Jacob, who previously has been running the Italian section here at Bletchley, is sent out to take over the whole operation in Cairo. They set themselves up in the former Flora and Fauna Museum in Heliopolis. Heliopolis is the kind of fashionable suburb of Cairo where all the rich people live. And they take over this museum. I haven't been able to track down the museum because I believe it was demolished in the 1960s.
It conjures images, and this is highly fanciful, and probably based on watching The Mummy, of being in some sort of grand museum in Cairo, and a secret passage opens up when you press a certain artifact. I'm obviously being highly fanciful here, but it's another example of how they hide something really important and really secret behind something quite dull.
It's not even so much that they've hidden it. It's just, that's a big building that we can fit some desks in. And so you can imagine people sitting around with cases full of pressed flowers or rock samples or whatever it is, with a trestle table in front of it, doing their work, surrounded by museum artifacts of various kinds.
Conjures images of putting trestle tables up on the ground floor of Block B and working around
Alan Turing's
papers or something, yeah. So obviously there were some successes from this outpost and this operation. Can you give us a few examples? There was a deception plan that was quite effective. Tell me about that.
there's two sides to the story of Compass, because on the one hand, Wavell, the commander in Cairo, needed to know everything about the Italians, but he was also very concerned that the Italians would know everything about us. And one of the problems, Cairo was notorious throughout the war because it was full of spies working for all sorts of people and quite often working for several people at the same time. So it was very difficult to keep anything a secret in Cairo for very long. It was a very gossipy town. And so when he draws up the plan for the operation, he tells very, very few people. It's a real need-to-know thing, and he has hardly any orders written down. He prepares the information that the soldiers out in the desert need by telling them they're going to do a big exercise, and all the logistics are put in place as if they're going to do an exercise. He doesn't actually tell them there's going to be a battle. And at the same time, they release the rumour and produce radio messages and logistical paperwork to suggest that he's actually going to pull troops out of the desert and send them to Greece. Because already by this point, there's concern about possible German invasion of Greece. And the Italians are also fighting the Greeks in Albania, not very successfully. The Greeks fight the Italians very convincingly and defeat them. So he's able to put the story around that the troops in the desert are actually going to leave and are going to go off to Greece. So when they attack the Italians, it's a complete surprise to everybody concerned, not only the Italians, but also some of the troops involved, I suspect. But that's why the operation is such a success. Dudley Clark starts some of the very early deception operations using kind of dummy tanks and that stuff that goes on to be used in Fortitude. He's also famous for being arrested by the Spanish police in Madrid dressed as a woman, allegedly on some kind of spy mission.
This is a real example of a not well-known story. This genuinely is. I mean, we talk about little-known stories quite casually because there are so many, but this really is little-known. How have you winkled out the details from this? Where have you found this?
The military history of the story is quite famous because Wavell launched the operation as a what he called a five-day raid. He was trying to kind of keep the whole thing quite low-key and to keep people's expectations low. But what happened was they completely surrounded the Italian force in Egypt, and that force surrendered more or less en bloc. So he's suddenly confronted with 138,000 Italian prisoners, which, given that his own army is only about 30,000 strong, is a pretty impressive result. And as a consequence of that, the Italian defence of North Africa more or less collapses. And from December, the battle starts on 8th of December, they fight through into the spring of 1941 and get all the way round through the eastern part of Libya and capture a huge chunk of Italian territory and capture many, many more prisoners and put the Italians really on the back foot. And in many ways, that is why in 1941, Rommel and the famous Africa Corps get sent to North Africa. It's because the Italians are losing so badly by that point.
Front North Africa. Bei den ersten schweren Kämpfen verloren die Briten über 9000 Gefangene, 814 Panzerfahrzeuge und 127 Flugzeuge. Seit einigen Tagen sind neue schwere Kämpfe entbrannt. Wieder stehen die verbündeten deutschen und italienischen Truppen einem an Zahl und Material weit überlegenen Feind gegenüber.
And so the military operation is quite well known by aficionados of North Africa. But what's interesting is the SIGINT and the radio intelligence side of that story doesn't seem to have been brought out very much. The idea that we were listening to Italian codes. And if you read a lot of the literature about Bletchley Park and about code breaking, it tends to start with the breaking of the German Enigma codes that are used in North Africa. So famously Light Blue, which is one of the networks used in North Africa. And you find yourself turning back the pages of the book, trying to find the bit about the Italians, and it's not there. So it's an interesting story from that point of view. And what is striking as well is they'd broken all these Italian codes up until June 1940, but the Italians had a plan in place that the moment hostilities started, they would change them all. So basically they're having to start from zero in June. And by September, October, they've actually broken back into most of those. So they've done a pretty good job in a very short space of time.
And do you get the impression that there was quite solid confidence among the Italian military in the code systems they were using, as there was with German Enigma and Lorenz? I mean, the German faith in those systems was almost unshakable. You've got Dönitz adding the fourth rotor, clearly had doubts, but generally they were quite well held to be solid, weren't they?
I think the Italians are pretty comfortable that when they change everything in June, that's going to do the job. Inevitably, Operation Compass works against the codebreakers because the battle is so successful that a number of Italian headquarters are captured, and we actually capture codebooks in the course of the operation. It sounds great, capturing a codebook, but actually it's counterproductive, because if the other side know you've captured the codebook, then they change the code. And a number of Italian codes are changed.
That brings us back to the sinking U-boat, because then nobody can check what they've nicked from it. Yeah.
And the other thing is, because they're reading Italian naval ciphers, something like 10 Italian submarines are sunk in the opening months of the war. One is captured outright, and it appears in a newsreel being towed back to Alexandria, so the Italians have a pretty good idea that we've got it. Unfortunately, that means that all the Italian naval codes are changed in late 1940, and we never managed to read those again. They are a closed book to us for the remainder of the Italian involvement in the war. Something we'll be talking about later in the year, which is Battle of Matapan. The information about that is gained because, unusually for the Italians, they use Enigma to encipher some messages connected with that battle. And it's our breaking of their Enigma machines that allows us to find out about that. But their book codes at that point are still completely secure. So sometimes success can work against you in these things.
It just shows you the complexity and depth and breadth of what was being achieved here. That it was never just about one thing. It always fascinates me, and I think it's a really appealing aspect of it, that those people involved in it won't have known. Most of them won't have had any idea how complex different bits of it were. So people working on German Enigma, even if they were quite senior and had quite a lot of knowledge about what was going on, wouldn't have known anything about this.
But you also have to look at or appreciate the determination of the people involved. One of the people who was involved with Italian codes describes how they had code books. The technical difference between codes and ciphers, these are technically codes in the sense that you have a dictionary of words and phrases which then have numbers associated with them, and you create the message by taking the numbers that refer to the words. And you then do a process where you take a random number and add it to the number you've already got, which produces a third number that's not recognisable. That's basically how they work. And so these teams had spent, in some cases, years gradually working out what each code number meant and assembling dictionaries of what all the terms were and how it all worked. And then suddenly in June 1940, they're told, it's changed, start again. And that's literally what they do. They just have to go back to square one and go, right, how did we do this last time? Let's start again. And fortunately, the system is similar enough the second time round, because the Italians don't want to retrain all their radio operation and everything. So they come up with a system that's similar to the old one. But of course, all the detail has changed. So the code breakers just have to go back to the beginning and go, right, where do we start? That doggedness and that ability to accept that kind of setback and just crack on, I think, is really impressive.
I think that's quite characteristic of the efforts here generally as well. Fascinating. Thank you.
In order to win the war, Hitler must destroy Great Britain. With every month that passes, the many proud and once happy countries he is now holding down by brute force and vile intrigue are learning to hate the Prussian yoke and the Nazi name as nothing has ever been hated so fiercely and so widely among men before. And all the time, masters of the sea and air, the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world will be on his track, bearing with them the swords of justice. The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it, he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O union, strong and great. Humanity with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer which I will give. to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
On the 30th of October, 1942, young men swam to a sinking U-boat and found Enigma codebooks and other intelligence treasures. Two of them went down with the U-boat, but they didn't die in vain. Their bravery ended a devastating 10-month blackout on naval Enigma and allowed the codebreakers at Bletchley Park to read German shipping messages for the rest of the war. Among those who helped to launch this mini-exhibition in Naval Codebreaking Hut 8 were family members of one of the men who died and the filmmakers who've created the moving animation which tells the story.
Dawn, 30th of October, 1942. A periscope and the outline of a submarine are spotted by a Royal Air Force patrol aircraft in the eastern Mediterranean. This sighting will be a vital turning point at Bletchley Park. HMS Batard and three other warships are on the scene by 10 a.m. and spend the next 10 hours hunting and depth-charging the U-boat. Night has fallen when the submarine is finally forced to surface after sustaining serious damage.
Phil Shanahan, author of The Real Enigma Heroes, and Aaron and Mike, who've made this wonderful bespoke animation to tell this story. So you're all here and getting your first impressions of what it's like to see it in context. Phil, what do you make of this? Being so close to this story, it must be quite strange.
Yeah, I think the word probably emotional would come in as well, because Bletchley Park rightly celebrates the mathematicians and the code breakers. But there's another side of the story, which is more to do with raw courage at sea. You know, men sacrificing their lives to bring the final clues to Bletchley Park for people here to actually crack those codes. And that's a story that I've been involved in. And it is quite emotional to see that story suddenly come into Bletchley Park. It's part of the Bletchley story, but it's the other side of it, if you like.
The animation really captures the emotion of it. Was that something that jumped out to you of this story from early on?
I think it's hard when you're making a film, you kind of get a bit wrapped up in the sort of technical sort of hurdles of it. I mean, we're just releasing it today, but one of the things that feels really good to me is the few people that I have shown it to have said they weren't even really sort of paying attention to the animation because the emotion of the story really hit them. And so they watched it again to tell me about what they thought of the technical side. I suppose that's always what you're attending. You're always hoping to elicit an emotional response, but I don't remember another film people saying that to me, like the first thing they say, so that feels great.
I think also just, it is just such an emotional story, and just when people watch the film, they don't realise that they weren't expecting that two men were going to die. You usually have these like heroic stories and everybody lives happily ever after at the end. And it's actually a really sad story that, you know, obviously two of the men sacrificed their lives just to get these code books and all these other amazing kind of what is called in the film, you know, Enigma treasures out of the U-boat. And then also the story of Tommy Brown, who, having done this like amazing act of heroism, died only a year later, so young. It is just a very sad and emotional story, but also a heroic and amazing story. Yeah.
Phil, how did you stumble across this story in the first place?
I came into it as a journalist, actually. I was in the Tamworth Herald newspaper in Staffordshire, and the story ended up on my desk, possibly that we got a story about a chap that had made a huge individual contribution to the turning of the war. So at first we just thought that's quite ridiculous. A huge pinch of salt was involved, if you like.
Just they all say that.
Exactly, yeah. You know, my granddad.
Proud families, yeah.
So proud families. But we decided there was something about it, if you like, that I thought, better look into this. And we went straight to the top fairly early on. I mean, we went to Robert Harris, the author of Enigma. And he said that without this man and his two colleagues, there may never have been a D-Day. I Googled the three names up, and there was not a single mention of them on the internet at that time. It was before any recognition or any sort of public recognition of that story had come out. So you can imagine on a small weekly newspaper at the time, when you suddenly think this is a story that's not just important locally, this is a story that's got worldwide significance to it.
It struck gold.
But it's not really out there enough, exactly. And so that then turned into a long newspaper campaign, which went ballistic, it went international. And as a result of that, we had roads named after the men in Staffordshire. And the culmination was this huge, very beautiful three-anchor monument in Tamworth. Each anchor represents one of the men's lives. And a light comes on, it's lit every night in honour of the three men. Quite a beautiful sight. It was produced by a sculptor called Walenty Pytel. It was a world-class sculptor who had actually done work for the Queen. And it's a beautiful sight in Tamworth. So that was a major part of, if you like, the campaign. And then that led to the book, which was The Real Enigma Heroes, which, as I said earlier, was named because of the film the Americans produced, which almost stole the story, if you like.
In this case, I think truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes, exactly.
You couldn't make this up, could you?
It is. The book itself is called The Real Enigma Heroes for a reason, and now the real story is in Bletchley. And I think that's the most important thing to me, really, to see that real story here. But as you say, yes, it's like a pure Hollywood story anyway. The three young men, I mean, one of them was 16, for example. That would be very far-fetched that a chap so young took part in such an important war event, if you like.
It sounds like he wasn't meant to, and he just dived in and decided to go and get involved and probably had that real gung-ho fearlessness of his youth.
He's a canteen assistant.
His family must have had no idea.
No.
None of their families did. The families of the two that died that night must have known that they died in action.
Mm.
But they can't have known how important what they did was. And they died not knowing how important it was. That's very poignant, isn't it?
Their families, their parents didn't realise. And when I was doing my research for my book, I came across headlines such as Colin Grazier, one of the men, died in an unsuccessful mission. That was written about in the, I think, 70s, I saw it. His father used to wear his medal at Remembrance Day parades. We had pictures in the Tamworth Herald of him going around with the medals on. But he died under the impression that Colin died in an unsuccessful mission. It couldn't have been further from the truth. He died in a mission which changed the course of the war.
So when did his family actually find out after your book?
Around about that time, that's when they found out, which is extraordinary when you think about it. Yeah. Sadly, his wife, that was, I think, the saddest one for us in a way, because Colin Grazier's wife was alive, and she'd always obviously been incredibly upset about what happened because they only had 2 days of married life together before he set off on this mission. And then she remembers that at the train station, he had a very strange reaction. Just as he left at the train station, he shouted at her, "Don't look back at me when I get on the train." And that haunted her for years and years and years, that he had this strange reaction. It was almost like a premonition of the sort of mission he was going to take part in, but we'll never know. But that haunted her. And for years and years, she remembered that. When the campaign came out, unfortunately, she was quite elderly, but also she had to go into a home and she was suffering from Alzheimer's. So she didn't really understand about the campaign and the efforts to, if you like, get the truth out of what he did. But there was one really good moment. There was one moment of clarity she had in the home. And apparently what we'd done is we'd done a feature on the wedding day. We put all the wedding pictures in. She'd seen them in the home. And like you can have with Alzheimer's, she had a rare moment of clarity. And she started crying and she was going, "Look at what they're doing for Colin." And she was reading all about him. Sort of 5 minutes after that, she wouldn't have known it again. But I'm really grateful for those few seconds of clarity, if you like, that she connected then with, if you like, the campaign to honour Colin and everything that he'd done.
Putting myself in your shoes, I think I would want to be able to tell the men themselves how important it was.
Absolutely.
That is the tragedy of it, isn't it? That they don't know their contribution. And does it feel like now that you've gone some way to help make up for that?
You can't make up for the people who passed away. You can't make up for the fact that, say, Colin's father died thinking he'd taken part in an unsuccessful mission. But then again, what we can do for the nation, if you like, is give them their rightful place in history. And I think what we've done today what you've done today at Bletchley Park has given them that kind of profile back. And that's a profile they really deserve.
Well, some of their families will be popping in. Hopefully you can see some reflected pride in their faces and feel glad that you've contributed to this story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chaotic scenes unfold as the enemy crew start to abandon ship. Knowing the U-boat could contain vital intelligence which could be utilised by the Allies, Tanny Fasson, the first lieutenant on Petard, and able seaman Colin Grazier immediately leap into the sea and swim through a mass of fleeing U-boat men towards the U-559. They are followed by Naffy canteen assistant Tommy Brown. Cold and wet, Fasson and Grazier board the submarine. climbing down the conning tower into the blackness below.
I'm joined by Sarah Kay, Digitisation and Exhibitions Officer, who put together this exhibition, and our research historian, David Kenyon. These two have been living and breathing this story for a little while now, and so to see it come to fruition today, and to see Tony Fasson in particular react to it with that very personal connection, what's that like when you've thrown yourself headlong into a story like this?
I think from my point of view, to get the family endorsement was really special, because if they're pleased with it, then that's really important. It means that we've given the story the credibility that it deserves. And it's obviously really sensitive and an important part of Bletchley Park's history. So it's nice to see something coming from nothing, and now it's available for everybody to see and soon to be online.
It can be difficult to think that you're going to get it right in the eyes of those people, because they're so closely connected to one person involved in something. They're bound to feel their importance perhaps overshadows other parts of the story, whereas you, separately from that, and to tell it in a fair and balanced way, have got to step outside of that. That must be quite difficult.
When you start researching, you often don't feel a connection with the story, and then you start to feel quite passionate and you also feel emotion towards it. So it was really important, and it meant a lot to see his reaction to it, because you could see that he was moved by it and that he was also proud of his uncle.
Yeah, it clearly was a powerful moment for them. It must make you feel quite proud that you've achieved
that. Yeah, absolutely. And it's always nice when you start doing an exhibition and it's literally words on a piece of paper, and then it becomes live and people see it and people can give their opinion of it. And it's always really nice to have positive feedback, obviously. But for it to become real and to tell it in an engaging way that people are able to react to is really nice.
And it's quite a different way to approach a story, because it's not object-led, it's story-led. The focus is this animation. This is a new way, really, that we focus a story, isn't it?
I think actually using an animation has been able to tell the story in a really emotional way, probably more emotional than we could have done it in any other way. So, for instance, the scene when you see Fasson and Grazier sinking, how else would you have been able to do that in such a poignant way? It's really moving.
Somebody put it quite nicely, I forget who. I think it was Aaron and Mike who made the animation. Mm. You think this is going to be a story that has a happy ending, and it doesn't. Mm. They all die. And you need to weave the somberness of that outcome into the way the story is told. The music is very much part of that, I think.
I actually showed it to my sister, who doesn't know anything about the Bletchley Park story. And she was watching it and she was thinking, oh, this is a lovely story. And then they obviously didn't make it out the UK. And she actually went, oh, that's war for you. She didn't realise that was coming. And then it picks it up again. It goes, you know, they didn't die in vain. And it suddenly makes you
see the value of what
they achieved. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's a really important message.
David, coming into this story as a code-breaking method, it's quite nice, isn't it, to connect it to daring and action and sacrifice in the field.
I think that's a really important part of this story, because all the other stories we tell in this hut and on much of the site are about activity here at Bletchley or in the outstations, which tends to be, put it simply, not very war-y. It's people sitting at desks doing things with pencils and paper. And it's really important that we remind people that there was a war on. It was a life and death story. You know, people's lives hung in the balance throughout this. And it required amazing efforts by all sorts of different people in different ways. And the guys on Petard is one example of that. The interesting thing for me has been that we've been over every frame of that animation time and time again from the first version. And obviously my role has been throughout to be incredibly picky and sort of point out
version 37.
Yeah, things like, you know, the serial number on the fourth rotor that's depicted has to be right, because we have visitors who have a level of expertise that if it was wrong, they'd notice. And even if they didn't notice, I want to get it right. That's, you know, it's my job and my passion is to get it right. But despite that, I still get a lump in my throat when I watch the film through, because familiarity hasn't killed any of the poignance of the story. You know, and especially now it's in situ and with people involved with the story present, it does still stop you a little bit like that. And I think that's really satisfying. That's what's nice about it. You know, Sarah, you probably feel the same, don't you, that familiarity hasn't bred any kind of contempt for it, has it?
I mean, I remember not long ago, it was a couple of weeks ago, when we were sat debating over the inquiry of Tommy's words of how he actually got on the U-boat from Petard, and it's just, I don't know, you start really stripping the story back, and you feel quite privileged that you're able to really do that, because most history has been told millions and millions of times before. We are in a privileged situation in that our history hasn't. We're still finding out things that people didn't know, and so you're really sort of getting to the bottom of what the story actually is. It gives you like a personal connection, like you're sort of flying the flag for them.
Into what he did.
Yeah.
And that great act of daring.
That's why I do my job and I like my job, is that when you get into the archival material, into the stuff from the National Archives, in there we're very lucky that there was a board of inquiry into the whole episode when they needed to decide what medals to award. And all the survivors were interviewed. And so Tommy Brown was still alive at that point, and you get his personal description of what he did and how he was involved, and as well as a number of other people who are quoted in there. And so you do get it absolutely from the horse's mouth, from the people who are involved. And handling those kind of documents and reading those kind of stories really up close is, that's why I'm here. I never tire of that.
Whilst the U-boat is gradually filling with water, the two men hand various Enigma treasures to Brown, who, after exploring the engine and control room, has positioned himself on the U-boat's conning tower. "Abandon ship!" Brown screams, and plunges into the dark waters to be rescued by the boat crew. At that moment, the ill-fated U-boat suddenly takes in an enormous amount of water and rapidly sinks, taking Tony Fasson and Colin Grazier with it. Bodies of Fasson and Grazier were never recovered. Almost certainly they drowned, trapped in the sinking submarine.
We're very lucky to be joined by Tony Fasson and Phil Shanahan. Now, more connected than anyone here to this story. Tony, what relation are you to Anthony?
Nephew.
How does it feel to be here today and see what we've done?
It feels absolutely tremendous, actually. And it's quite emotional, I have to say.
It's probably a little bit overwhelming, is it?
It is. It is.
I, you look a bit sort of, something's hit you between the eyes.
I do, I feel very emotional about it. Yeah.
How did you grow up with this story? When did you find out about it?
I suppose, when I was a child. It was spoken about, but not very much at all. It was just very, very low key within the family. So it wasn't until some years later on that we really knew the full story. My grandparents, they weren't told the full story after he died. Yeah, so it was not until, probably until my, late teens, that really knew what was happening. And it was publicised through the Hornet comic, which was in, I think it was July 1969.
Which was remarkable, because at the time it was still under the Official Secrets Act. A simple boys' comic actually blew a huge war secret, if you like. And I don't think anyone really understands how that came out.
Quite extraordinary. It told the story.
So it talks about Enigma codebooks details.
Absolutely.
Oh. Well, something I only learned the other day was, of course, from 1974 onwards, that's when Enigma machines began to flood the market, because they went out of use instantly when they realised we had been breaking it.
Yeah.
Because they were still using it. But it went under the radar in a boys' comic 5 years earlier than that. That's fascinating.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It really is extraordinary.
But you picked up on that, obviously.
Yes, because my father farmed just outside Kelso, and it was a neighbour that came up to the farm and said, "I think you should have a look at this."
Extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
Absolutely incredible. So it was obviously somebody very, very close to what actually happened.
Well, I wonder what happened to them.
Well, we tried to go through to the editor and find out, but nothing.
In fact, in my book, that story is reproduced. We've actually got a copy of the Hornet, and it actually named the men, and it said that they'd retrieved priceless treasure.
And so did that become a sort of depth charge through your family history, as it were, and change of view?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
And then did you start to try and look into it as a family more?
Then I think by that time, I think my father certainly knew what had happened. But at that time, I was away from home, so I didn't really pick up on it till later on, probably in the, mid-70s or something like that.
And I take it you know Phil, and you've been in touch before now and been part of the campaign that Phil spearheaded.
No, I haven't, actually. Curious enough, it was my aunt who was involved.
That's right,
Gina. Yeah.
But I did meet Tony at Earl's Court when they were having a sort of run of the actual story.
Indeed.
at a book signing there, and Tony came up and introduced himself, and it was a strange moment for me. I was explaining to him earlier because he came over and said, "Hello, I'm Tony Fasson." And I did have a double take. I thought maybe Colin Grazier might be alongside him and Tommy Brown, but he did explain then, and yeah, it was wonderful to meet him because he's got such a proud family story there.
Indeed, to carry the name.
He's looking to see how solid you were, if you were actually real.
Yes.
This must be a proud day then. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but...
It is extremely, it is. I feel very emotional about it, I'm afraid, especially having just watched the film there. Yeah.
That is a very moving, very telling of the story. Yeah. I'm glad that you're proud and happy to see it.
Yes, and it's been celebrated in the correct way.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
The 1940s boutique is back at Bletchley Park throughout 2016. It's a day spent steeped in vintage glamour, where Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo Wop Doos teaches a bevy of beauties how to create the iconic 40s look, including victory rolls and the tricks of make, do and mend makeup. At the last boutique in December, Bletchley Park's events manager, Katie McNaughton, had a chat with Sarah to get a taste of what makes it such a special day.
Well, for a start, Bletchley Park's the perfect place for this. I mean, everything we teach is very relevant to the park. If you go around the exhibition spaces, you'll obviously be able to see the women at the park and just check out the hair. It's fantastic. But yeah, the boutique's been very popular, I think, because vintage is really big at the moment. But obviously everything we're doing, we're putting in a historical context and we're relating back, you know, to what was going on during the Second World War and the levels of austerity people were under. And we're sort of showing how something very glamorous and quite incredible came out of such austerity. So it just really relates to people, I think, at the moment.
So what is it about vintage glamour that appeals to you?
Oh, there's so much. But the 40s in particular, again, I mean, just the hardship. I've got a lot of respect for the people at the time. And what they did, it looks so beautiful. You know, I love wearing my victory rolls. I've got them on now. I'm 6 foot and I put my hair, like, you know, a foot up. But, you know, the way people talk to me about my hair, people are really interested. They're always sort of fascinated by it. I sort of walk down the street and a lot of people stop me and have a chat with me about it. I think people are really into it and it looks so incredibly glamorous.
Why do you think we like to look back in fashion?
I think at the moment we're quite reflective. I think people are very interested and there's a real feeling of wanting to know about our history. And, you know, what better way to learn about daily life than looking at women's hair and makeup routines? I mean, it tells you a lot about what was going on at the time.
So how would you describe the 1940s look?
It's very bold. There's very structured hair. It's very clean shape-wise, you know, lots of curls, big piles of curls, bright red lipstick. And just, yeah, a very glamorous, very tailored look, very put together, you know, which is incredible considering.
There's also a social history in this as well.
Absolutely. And I think what we're trying to do with the workshop is put everything in context with it. So you learn about why the hair was worn up. You know, when we were working in the factories, it was incredibly important not to be catching yourselves in the machinery. You know, everything was born out of a real necessity and actually happened for a reason and then became sort of fashion in the 50s as well. So we really look at the whole context of it. And yeah, it's a very fascinating period of our history.
Give us a little insight into what we can expect.
Well, what's worked particularly well this year is we've really looked at different sort of seasons. So I've done festival hair for, you know, all the vintage festivals that happen in this area over the summer, which has been great. So we did 3 days of festival hair where we looked at kind of keeping your hair going if you're staying in a tent. Today, actually, we've looked at sort of some festive styles for Christmas parties. We're just kind of changing up a little bit. So there are different hairstyles at different times of the year. We did a Valentine's one this year. So you can look through and you can pick the ones that you want to do and the skills that you want to pick up, really.
What's your favourite 1940s look?
Do you know what? It's got to be victory rolls. When you come to the course, you'll see that you can wear them so many different ways and everybody does them differently. You know, however many people are on the course, they'll all put their own spin on it. And that's what's so nice. You know, we are modern ladies. We have all the modern tools at our disposal. We're allowed to put our own take on it.
Well, thank you very much for the insight into 1940s.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lindsay, what made you come today?
I'm a Lindy Hop dancer, but I can never get the look. I can buy the clothes and I can put some makeup on, but I cannot get the 1940s look. So here I am to get the victory roll.
Fantastic. And what is it that you've enjoyed so far today?
The tips that have been given have been great. And also the confidence to maybe try it in the future on my own. So it's the confidence, but also some great tips.
And what is it that you like about the 1940s look?
Very glamorous, very sleek. And the whole sort of era comes together in well-crafted materials and garments, but also the hair is just so different from now. So it just is very different, very glamorous.
What's your favourite look from the 1940s?
I did like all the curls at the back and when they managed to pin them up at the back, especially with the little Victor Rose, but the curls all pinned up at the back. Yeah, pinwheel. Absolutely. Very elegant, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The next 1940s boutique is on the 6th of February. Details are on our website. And we'll be announcing the rest of 2016's events very soon. Watch this space. Veteran Betty Webb has been awarded the MBE for promoting and remembering Bletchley Park. At a sprightly 92, Betty is prolific on the school circuit, as she's keen to tell future generations about the vital work carried out here during World War II. A few weeks ago, she made the journey to Buckingham Palace for her investiture ceremony, a proud day for Betty and her family, and she told podcast producer Mark Cotton what it was like to be at the palace as an honoured guest.
So it's been a few months since we spoke to you last, Betty, and when we did, you'd just been told that you were going to be awarded an MBE. Since then, you've been to London and you've had your award, haven't you?
I certainly have.
Go back to when we spoke to you in the summer. You said how difficult it was just trying to keep that secret, didn't you?
Well, yes, it was, because I wanted to tell all my friends about the joyous news. And the ruling is that once you've been notified officially, you may not say anything to anybody until it's announced in the press, which meant I had to keep everything to myself for 7 weeks.
Now, for someone who kept a secret for 30 years, you'd think that wouldn't be that difficult, really, would you?
Oh, but it was. It was much more difficult because the splendid event meant that I wanted to tell all my friends and relations about it. So I thought, well, I know how to keep a secret, so keep it I will. And I did. I didn't tell a soul. I got told off, actually, afterwards for not telling them before then.
So can you tell us a bit about the actual day?
Yes, indeed I can. It meant getting up terribly early because the instructions were to be at the palace between 10 and 10:15 a.m. And if you're not there on time, you can't be invested. It means coming back another day. And when you think about the travelling and the expense of the hotel and all the other things connected, it would have been a nightmare. Anyway, we did arrive on time.
So I'm sure you did, yes.
Yes, no, that was absolutely marvellous. Of course, the first thing you see driving into Buckingham Palace are these splendid gates, which in fact were made in Bromsgrove, which is my constituency.
Just down the road, yes.
That's right, yes. So that's always exciting. And then we, because one of my guests was in a wheelchair, we were taken right up to the palace, to the door from where there is a lift, and a lovely lady pushing the wheelchair. And she took us in, and then that's the moment when you're parted from your guests, and they are looked after, by, in this case, by the girl who was pushing the wheelchair, and recipients go into the most enormous gallery you've ever seen in your life, which is all part of the Buckingham Palace collection. And you wait there until you're called, because we don't all go in together.
No.
There are some 200 recipients gathered. And you wait until your name is called and go in with another 10 or 12 people. And because my name begins with W, down.
You had a long wait.
I had a very long wait.
Because you've had a long wait for this investiture, haven't you, really? I mean,
yes.
We spoke to you in July and
yes.
It's now late November.
That's right.
So, yeah, there's some disadvantages to having a name of Webb, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes. I had the same problem when I was in Bletchley, actually, because my name then began with V, and it meant I was always at the back of the pay queue. And I used to say to myself, I must marry a man called Brown, and of course I married Webb, didn't I?
I know you'd been looking forward to hopefully it being Her Majesty the Queen. You'd be holding the investiture that day, because obviously you had a lot in common, because you were both in the ATS.
That's right, yes.
But unfortunately, you sort of like ships that passed in the night. She was up this way that day, wasn't she?
She was in Birmingham, which is near where I live.
Yes, so who did you have on the day?
That was an irony. However, I was fortunate in having His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, who seemed very interested in my subject. We had a little chat. I told him about my trouble with keeping secret for 7 weeks, which seemed to amuse him quite well, I think. And then he said, did I know Baroness Trumpington? And I said I did. And had he read her book, which he said he had? He then thanked me very much for what I had been doing at Bletchley and shook me very warmly by the hand. And that was the end of the interview.
But you were saying to me where the band was.
Yes, well, the investitures are held in the ballroom and up in the gallery, immediately opposite whoever is doing the investing, there was a small orchestra playing a lovely variety of both classical and modern music, very quietly, which is lovely. It meant you could talk without being drowned. And the other wonderful thing for me was that my three guests were actually sitting in the front row, so they were able to see and hear everything, which was great.
Can you just read out your official...
Oh, yes, indeed. The reason for my MBA.
The reason
yes, that's
for your
right.
MBA.
Well,
because that's the important
thing. That's the important thing.
Bit, isn't
it's important for me too, because it says, for services to remembering and promoting the work of Bletchley Park, which I've been doing since about 1994. The investiture was not anything to do with my wartime work, only what I've been doing, as I say, from 1994 roughly. And up to date, I've given about 140 talks.
Yeah, and you've already got some booked for next year, haven't you?
Yes, I have quite a number booked for next year already.
I spoke to you at the start of the summer and you were talking about someone was already booking you for about 13 or 14 months' time.
That's absolutely right.
Because there's a lot of call for your tour.
Well, it seems so, yes.
I think because you did that really specific task at Bletchley with the paraphrasing and, of course, you went on to work at the Pentagon, I think that really fascinates people.
Yes, I think it does. They can't quite get their heads around it, I think.
And you've got such an engaging way of telling it. And you'll no doubt say the same. You feel it's recognition for you and everyone at Bletchley,
don't
you?
Oh, it's for everyone, yes.
But, you know, I can sit here and say to you, it is because of all the hard work that you've done for Bletchley Park over the last few years in promoting the park and the museum. But the way that you do that, it's always not you talking about yourself, it's you talking about your colleagues, isn't it?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, the object of the exercise is to begin with to tell the public what went on at Bletchley, give them a bit of an idea as to the whole picture, the different parts which led up to actually being able to make use of the enemy messages. And, of course, now that we've had this film, The Imitation Game, impress upon people that they should really understand that it's only part of the picture.
Yeah, they can watch a really interesting, dramatic World War II film, but then come and find the real story at Bletchley Park, can't they?
Yes, yes.
And that's why, really, you've been awarded this MBA.
I think also because I have been talking to schools quite a bit, to perhaps 13, 14-year-olds.
Do you find them interested? Do you find them engaged?
Yes, very interested, especially as I start off by saying, when I was your age, we didn't have telephones like that, like the ones you've got in your hand. And you see a lot of rather bemused faces then. And
it is another world to them, isn't it?
It's another world to them, that's right. But by and large, they seem to be very interested. They had a certain amount of background already before I spoke with them. But I think it's fair to say that I was received quite well by the youngsters.
At any of our events, people are just absolutely in awe of any of the veterans, and they always love an event that you're talking at. They always go down well. So I can imagine the school children would just be absolutely in awe of you.
I think that's right. They are genuinely interested.
And this is part of what we talk about at Bletchley. It's not just the service that you and your colleagues gave during the war. I look at it as your continuing service. For a lot of people, World War II finished, you know, in 1945 or 1946, and they were demobbed. In a way, our veterans continued that service in silence for another 30 years. And then some of you, we're lucky enough to still have around, are still continuing that service in a way because you're helping to promote the park and carry on telling that story, and not just your own story. I think with most of the veterans, it's not, I want to tell my story, I want to tell our story, isn't it?
Oh, no, that's absolutely right, yes. And to fill people in on a very important part of our history, because it is believed we shortened the war by between 2 and 3 years. And that is very important, because otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here now as we are. As somebody said to me recently, we would all be speaking German.
We would, and that's a verboten.
Verboten, yeah.
Well, Betty, can I just say congratulations? It's an award well-deserved for all the work you've done for Bletchley Park. And again, just thank you for your service and your ongoing service.
Well, thank you, and I plan to go on.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.